Right? So why is this being done to her? Why do we assume, well, you know, she behaved like an animal? So, you know, a story about the, there's a Rosh Yeshiva. Rosh Yeshiva, right? You know, got Rosh Yeshiva calls in one of the, you know, from Yeshiva, Meir Sharon, wherever it was, Ben Hebrak. He calls in one of the guys. He says, you know, Zalman Zelig Chaim Yankel, whatever the guy's name is, Zalman, you're being thrown out of the Yeshiva. Thrown out of the Yeshiva? Why am I being thrown out of the Yeshiva? Somebody told me he saw you walking down the street with a girl, you were holding hands. Right? He says, yeah, but Rebbe, it's not true. He says, what? It should be true? What that means, the very fact that you've brought the suspicion on yourself can't be good. The very fact that you're even in a situation where somebody suspects you means your behavior, it's what we call halakhically questionable behavior, right? Doesn't mean you're obviously, maybe you didn't, right?
But what if someone's lying?
One second. The fact that, don't worry about, don't let the story give you, it's only a story, right? Probably never have, right? The sota is a woman, she has already entered a situation where her behavior has already been behavior that's deplorable, even if she ends up innocent, right? The fact that she's secluded, she's a married woman who is alone with another man. Therefore, they bring her sacrifice. The sacrifice is made out of this barley meal. Normally, they mix oil with all the sacrifices in the base of meat. When they bring wheat or flour offerings, they normally mix oil in with it. A sota sacrifice does not have oil mixed in with it. Oil symbolizes light. Oil is what's used for fire. Her behavior obviously took place in the dark. They take water from the kior. The kior was this basin that they had in the base of the Megiddo. It had water in it. They take water from the basin. They pour the water into the basin. And they erase Hashem's name. They write Hashem's name on a piece of parchment. And they drop this parchment into the water. And Hashem's name, which under normal circumstances is unimaginable and absolutely prohibited, to erase Hashem's name, to even say Hashem's name in vain, is a prohibition. To go and erase Hashem's name, you know that to make a bracha, where a bracha is unnecessary, is an absolute prohibition. If I pick up an apple, I say, I take a bite. I say, gee, you know, a good apple. I think I'm going to thank him again. Right? I say it again. It's a prohibition. I've taken Hashem's name in vain. There was no reason for me to be mentioning Hashem's name. To walk around just saying, Hashem, 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 to say it even in English, right? To say G-O-D. For no purpose is considered taking Hashem's name in vain, right? So it's a severe prohibition. Here we take Hashem's name, we write it on the parchment, and then we dissolve the parchment in the water. Now, she then takes the water. The Kohen administers an oath to the woman where the woman insists that she's innocent. If at any point she admits, up until the point where the name was erased, if at any point she admits that she is guilty, she does not drink the water, the couple simply gets divorced, she goes home, she's committed a very grave offense against the Torah, but she does not drink the water. If she insists on her innocence, the Torah says, we erase Hashem's name, we take the water, they mix in a little bit of dirt to symbolize that that's where she may return to. She may return to dirt. And then she is given this water to drink. She drinks the water. Somebody once asked what the bracha is. The water is. Probably a bracha achrona, right? The final bracha, right? She drinks the water, and if she is guilty, then the Torah describes some type of gruesome death, where her stomach swells, she falls apart. She doesn't, somebody once translated it, she explodes. She does not explode. Oh. Right? Misconception, she explodes. It doesn't say anywhere that she explodes, like an after dinner mint, right? She doesn't explode. She simply drinks the water, her stomach swells, and she dies this very gruesome death. They quickly rush her out of the base of Migdash, and then she dies this very gruesome death. That's if she's guilty. If she is innocent, then the Torah says that if she had difficulty giving birth, her births will become easier. If she was childless, she will have children. If her children weren't very beautiful, then the children will become beautiful. She will actually be rewarded for having gone through this public humiliation. Okay? That's the mitzvah of the sota. There's an additional mitzvah that all the women in the vicinity when this is done, this is a public display. Just remember what's going on here. You're taking a woman who's accused, she's being accused. Imagine what would happen nowadays if you picked up the Jerusalem Post and you saw a picture of a woman in the Jerusalem Post, and the headlines would be, "This woman is accused of adultery." Right? You think the woman would be embarrassed and humiliated? Absolutely. And that's only in the newspaper. Here, she's in the Beis HaMikdash. We try to gather an audience, as large an audience of women as possible, so that all the women should watch what's happening to this woman, because there's nothing to encourage a person to avoid negative behavior as much as watching the public humiliation. The Kohen Gadol undoes her, the Kohen, who's administering, he undoes her, he uncovers her hair, right? It's actually one of the sources that we see that a woman, a married woman's hair should be covered. He uncovers her hair, because uncovered hair for a married woman is a sign of degradation, and he rips part of her garments in order that she should be publicly humiliated, and then he gives her to drink. She drinks it. If she's guilty, she dies, and if she's innocent, then she's going to have a certain amount of children, or the children will be, if she's childless, she'll have children. Now, the first, there are a couple of questions here. First of all, who are we talking about? We're talking about a frum woman, right? We're talking about a frum woman. I picture any woman from any woman in Me'ashar, right? Any woman in Bnei Brak. You're talking about a woman. She's gone to Beis Yaakov. She's a frum girl. She wears skirts down to here, right? And she's, here's a frum woman. How did she get to the point where she is now becoming a public spectacle, or where her husband even suspects her? How could a woman even be suspected? A frum woman even suspected of committing adultery? How do you get to such a point? So Rabbi Dessler explains, everybody has what's called a point of free choice. It is a fundamental concept in Judaism. Everybody has what's called a point of free choice. If I were to put a gun down on the table right now, and I would say, anybody in the room who wants could pick up the gun and shoot anyone else in the room. Right? Put a gun down on the table. I'm looking around just to make sure that I don't think anybody here, I would bet every penny that I have, that nobody here would pick up the gun to shoot anybody else. Not only that, nobody here would even be tempted to pick up the gun and shoot anybody else. Nobody here would have the battle. Let's make the example a little more realistic. I don't know what you do in private. I don't know what anybody here does in private. If I would put down a big cheeseburger right here on the table, right? A massive cheeseburger, right? And remember, it's almost supper time and I know you're hungry, right? And I put down any kind you want. And I put it down here on the table. And I say, I'm going to turn my back. Anybody in this room right now, as long as you stay right here, you can eat the cheeseburger. I would still bet all my money that nobody in the room would do that. Not only that, you wouldn't even have the temptation. Why? If for no other reason than the fact that all eyes are on you. Right? May not be God that we're afraid of, but at least we're afraid of people. Why not? The reason is because we have a certain point of free choice. Certain tests that we're given are within the framework of our free choice. They become difficult for us. Should I do it? Shouldn't I do it? There are other tests that we're given that are completely beyond our point of free choice. It's not even a battle. I don't even have a battle with it, right? For instance, right now I don't have a battle with non-kosher food at all. You put a cheeseburger on the table, I'm only using myself as an example because I'm one of the 36 of the generation. I'm one of the 36 of the generation. You put a cheeseburger on the table, I don't even have a battle with the cheeseburger, right? It doesn't even tempt me. What does that mean? That for the rest of my life, I'll never have battles with cheeseburgers? Not at all. Right now, it's beyond the parameters of the field of battle. Right? Pay attention carefully. It's beyond the parameters of my battle range. What happens to me today? Today I'm eating kosher food, and I'm making brachas properly. What if today, when I eat, I kind of don't pay attention to my brachas so well? I get lazy when it comes to my brachas. Tomorrow, when I eat, I may not make my brachas at all. The next day when I eat kosher food, but of questionable supervision. And then on the day after that, I'll eat a cheeseburger. So what's happened? The whole field has shifted. That means the battleground has shifted relative to where the individual is standing in his service of God. Why does it happen that way? Because it's ridiculous to take a person who's on this level of spirituality and to try for the evil inclination to tell him, okay, you're up over here, I'm going to get you to do this avera over here. It's ridiculous. It's not going to happen. Somebody who is, you're not going to get Rabbi Moshe Feinstein to go and worship idols. It's not even a battle for him. It's not even a battle for us. It's not a battle for us where we stand right now. But if we start slowly but surely shifting over, eventually you see the field of battle changes. I could tell you from personal example. I know when this happens to me. It happens every time. It happens all day, every day. The battles come at you fast and furious. But I know from a personal experience that every time I go to the United States, it's a hard at all to watch television. Right? It's not even something I don't even think twice about it. It doesn't even tempt me. Yet when I go to Chutz Lartz and I'm in an environment where there is a television, then it does tempt me. Now, it happens to be that I'm one of the strong ones, so I just managed to overcome. But the fact is that there's a temptation, right? The field of battle has shifted. The field of battle has constantly shifted. This woman, she didn't start out one day. She had a great marriage. She was married to some guy living in Mea Shearim. She had 14 children. And then all of a sudden, one day, her husband said, "You know what, Zelda? I don't want you to see you alone with Bernie." Doesn't happen that way. What happens is the shift begins one step at a time. One day, she maybe dresses in a way that is not appropriate for her. She changes her style just a little bit. The next day, she changes her style a little bit more. The next day, she goes to a social gathering where there's no mechitza, and she starts socializing with the men. And then after that, she finds a guy, and she's sick. Right? It's a long process. It doesn't happen overnight. That's why she's called a sota. She's a woman who has strayed. That means the minute you stray off of the beaten path, that means you are now causing your field of battle to shift. The more it shifts, a person suddenly finds himself doing actions, averas, that were previously unimaginable to that individual. Okay? Now, what needs explanation is, you know that in the entire Torah, with all of the halachic, all the halachas in the Torah, and all the halachic activity in the Torah, this is the only action in the Torah, the only halachic question in the Torah that is settled by supernatural means. Understand that. That means it's the only time in the Torah we find this was something that was stopped during the time of the Second Temple. But up until the Second Temple, this was the only halachic activity settled by supernatural intervention. But that means God intervenes supernaturally over here, and he shows whether or not, by drinking the water, God will demonstrate whether or not this woman is guilty or innocent. Now, why does God have to intervene over here? Right? That's A. B, why does God allow his name to be erased? God allows his name to be erased, something which God says in the Torah, erase his name in order for to see if he's guilty or innocent. So the bottom line here, the goal of this entire mitzvah is to, number one, maintain the purity of the Jewish people, and number two, it's to retain what's called, you've heard the expression, shalom bayis. Shalom bayis means peace and harmony in the home. The Gemara says that when a couple gets divorced, the mizbeach, the altar, and the Beis HaMikdash sheds tears. When a couple gets divorced, even the base of the altar and the Beis HaMikdash cries. What does that mean? That means that every single home has the potential to be a Beis HaMikdash. A home is referred to as a miniature Beis HaMikdash. If that home splits, then so to speak, quote unquote, the altar cries. That means it's been a destruction of a Beis HaMikdash. The Torah comes along and says, we have to restore peace between the husband and his wife. A man who suspects his wife of adultery, let's say they go to court, and the judges in the court say, you know what, we've examined all the evidence, she's innocent. Do you think that that's going to restore the husband's faith in his wife? The husband always has in the back of his mind, perhaps the judge has made a mistake. Perhaps she's guilty, and the judges didn't pick it up. In order to maintain the peace in the Jewish home, in order to keep this couple together, God comes along and says, you know what? First of all, we're going to do it with supernatural intervention. That means, when she drinks the water, and my name's been in there, and nothing happens to her, the husband now can go home secure in the knowledge that his wife is innocent. Because if she wasn't innocent, then she would have drunk the water and she would have died. So it goes beyond the human judgment of the court. It's now God intervening, and God is saying to the husband, you can be sure that your wife is innocent. That's first of all. What is symbolized by the fact that God allows his name to be erased? God is allowing his name to be erased in order that the husband and the wife should remain together. Right? Why is God allowing his name to be erased? So the commentaries say, one of the ingredients necessary for a successful marriage is each one of the partners has to focus on not being obstinate. Right? Golden advice. You don't always have to get the last word in. Right? You don't have to get the last word in. Not only that, you have to be willing to forego your own honor and your own dignity the same way that God is willing to let his name be erased. You know the story, the guy walking with his wife along the beach. Right? Husband and wife are walking along the beach, and it's a nice moonlit night, and the husband says to his wife, "Hey, Zelda, beautiful night, moon's out, the stars. Look at that, look out in the distance, look at those ships." And Zelda says, "Yeah, beautiful ships." And the husband says, "Yeah, when's the last time we saw two beautiful ships like that?" And Zelda says, I don't remember, but there aren't two of them, there are three of them. And Zelda says, "No, Zelda, there are two." He says, no, there are three. Right? And I said, "There are two." "There aren't two, there are three." And they start arguing. Finally, you know, they're arguing. Finally, he strangles her. Right? He takes her wife. He strangles her. He picks up her body. He dumps it into the sea. "I told you, there are two ships out there." He starts walking away. A hand comes out of the water. Right? That means in marriage, sometimes the focus of the marriage, very often, the purpose of the marriage is to maintain peace and harmony. What happens is you can become so sidetracked in something so trivial, like getting in the last word. Every couple can argue. People can argue about, you know, "You said something." I didn't say that. You can argue for hours about a whole fight. You can ruin the whole evening out because you're arguing. Did you say that? You didn't say. Let me tell you something, children. You're all thinking to yourself, "When I get married, that's not going to happen. Because when I get married, I'm going to be so much in love that I'm going to overlook all these things." Right? Get in line, fellas. Right? We all thought that. Right? All of a sudden, all these little petty arguments, they matter because you've got two people, you've got two egos clashing with each other. Obviously, if you work on yourself, it's not quite so bad. You will be irritated by the way people squeeze toothpaste, right? It's not just a story reading book, right? It actually happens. You'll find that sometimes people leave the cap off the toothpaste, right? All these little things that irritate. What's the bottom line? The bottom line is, like Roberto says, I'm allowing my name to be erased. I'm willing to step aside, set my dignity aside. You could set your dignity aside also in order to let the marriage flourish, right? So that's why in this mitzvah, the Torah, there's a supernatural element in this mitzvah. The Gemara says there was a man, I'll tell you two stories and where we'll stop. The Gemara says that there was a man who, he came home from shul Friday night, was ready for the Shabbos meal, and the Shabbos, the table, nothing was ready. His wife wasn't home. Finally, his wife comes home, and he says, "Sir, where were you?" She says, "Well, I was at a shir. Rabbi Meir was giving a shir." So the husband says, "Really? I want you to go to that Rabbi Meir. I want you to spit in his eye. And until you do, you're not all setting foot in this house." Right? So, you know, the wife is, you know, she's terribly humiliated. She can't come back in the house. She doesn't know what to do. She starts wandering over to the base measures. Gemara says, in the meantime, Rabbi Meir received a divine communication of what had gone on between this husband and his wife. So he's waiting there in the base measures. The woman walks in, and Rabbi Meir starts going, "Oh, my eye! Anybody here know the cure for a certain eye illness? Right? I need somebody who can spit in my eye 7 times. Right? So the woman, comes running up. Right? She spits in, because the Gemara says, she spits in Rabbi Meir's eye 7 times. Right? So Rabbi Meir says to her, after the 7th time, Rabbi Meir pulls his hand away from her and says, "Okay, listen, go home and tell your husband that he said to spit once, right? And you did even better, you spit 7 times, right?" And she goes home. So Rabbi Meir's disciple said to Rabbi Meir, "No, really, there is something called the dignity of Torah, right? For dignity of Torah, all you had to do was give us the word. We would have gone over, we would have whipped his hide, and he would have taken his wife back into the house. Right? What's with the spitting in the eye business?" Rabbi Meir said, "Then listen, the Torah says by the Sota that God is willing to set his side, his dignity, in order to make peace between a husband and a wife. I also am willing to set aside my dignity to make peace between a husband and a wife." The last, just one more, just also just to show you what's contained in Talmud Bavli, in case you don't believe me. Gemara says, an unbelievable story. The Gemara says, that there was a Babylonian man who went to Israel, and he married an an Eretz Yisrael woman, Jewish, right? Jewish man, married, but he came from Babylonia. People always ask, I told you when we spoke about marriage, people always ask about marrying a Yemenite girl or marrying this girl, that girl. You should always try to find somebody with a similar background to your own, because the communication gap in marriage could create severe problems. This man said to his wife, they had certain nuances in the language which were slightly different. He asked his wife for two pieces of beef to make him for supper, two pieces of beef, some sort of meat dish. He asked for two of them. His wife misunderstood because the word sounded very much like beans in Hebrew, right? So she made him two beans for supper, right? So he started getting a little upset. Finally, he asked his wife to bring him two melons, right? The word for melons in Hebrew is butzini. Now, the problem is that the words for candlesticks is also butzini, right? So the husband asked for two melons, and she shows up, she brings him two candlesticks, right? He got so upset with her, right? This is after a continuous relationship where they're miscommunicating. He got so upset with her, he said to her, take those two candlesticks. You can just see him gritting his teeth. Take those two candlesticks, and I want you to smash them on the bubba. You know what a bubba is? Right? Any of you have learned bubba mitzir or bubba kama? Bubba is a gate. He said, take those two candlesticks and smash them on the gate, on the bubba. Right? This woman walks out, and she happens to see that one of the sages, whose name was Bubba Ben Huta, right, is sitting right outside by the front gate. So she walks up to Bubba Ben Huta, and she clobbers him over the head. Gemara says, right? She broke both candlesticks on his head. Bubba Ben Huta, Gemara doesn't say, you think that, but he just said, Mahadein. Right, that means like,
what are you doing?
Why did you do that? Mahadein Dava. Why exactly did you do that? Right? She said to him, that's what my husband told me to do. So he said to her, Melissa, what would your reaction be? He said to her, you did the will of your husband, which is what a good Jewish wife should do. Hashem should give you two children like Bubba Ben Huta. Right? He gave her a blessing. Right? And she ends up having two children. They're great Torah scholars, right? The sages of the Talmud, Rav Meir, Bubba Ben Huta, they see through what's essential. My dignities, I've been insulted. Somebody spit in my eye. Somebody clobbered me over the head with candlesticks, right? But what's more important here? What's more important over here is that you send this woman home and she understands that the marriage relationship is the essential relationship in Torah Judaism, right? And that's the idea of the sota, and that's why the Torah gives us this cure for the sota to find out whether she's guilty or innocent. Any questions?
What happens if she's childless and she does it on purpose?
The Gemara, it's a very good question. The Gemara asks that question. There's a discussion in the Gemara. The assumption is most women will not do, they won't degrade themselves to that level. Gentlemen, Thursday we are going to discuss the laws of when you have to give up your life to sanctify God's name. All right, Kiddush Hashem.